Alicia Ostreicher, the state poet of New York from 2018 to 20, is the author of 15 poetry collections and another 7 books of essays and literary criticism. A chancellor of the Academy of American Poets since 2015, poetry hasn't always come easy to her. She talks about her struggle in writing her 2002 book, The Volcano Sequence, and how she overcame the darkness she encountered.
So I made a deal with the poems, different from anything I've ever done. If you agree to keep on arriving, I agree not to tell you what to say.
Stay with us to hear the award-winning poet and scholar, Alicia Ostreicher, as part of our State Poets Laureate series here on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam, and here's our 2003 archive show. Born in New York City in 1937, Alicia Ostreicher is considered one of America's major poets and critics. Winner of the William Carlos Williams Prize and twice nominated for the National Book Award, Ostreicher is known for her passion and fierce intellectual curiosity. Her poetry explores a broad spectrum of themes that make up our lives: love, sex, family, politics, religion, and art. Her nonfiction writings include 2 controversial books about the Bible, and 2 critical works focusing on women's poetry. Now considered one of our leading feminist critics, Alicia Ostreicher talks about her introduction to that world.
I began devouring women's poetry in the mid-70s, really after everybody else, because the women's poetry movement, I think, got started around 1960. But I took my head out of the sand and discovered it in the mid-70s.
You know, so many of your poems have to do with the woman's experience. There were a lot of poems that you included in the little space that had to do with childbearing and with raising children and dealing with teenage daughters,
right,
and just all the things that before women like you were writing poetry, we just don't see that kind of work before. So I can see how men might dismiss it.
They did. And from my perspective, we're told that poetry is supposed to be universal. Well, what is more universal
than life?
Than life. We read poems about love. We read poems about death. But what is more universal than bringing human beings into the world and raising them? And the way I like to see it is women's experience is human experience. And to write about the things that women experience is to add to the richness of what human experience is. I'm not a separatist. And I also think that women writing about these things has opened up space for men to do kinds of work that they never did before. More men write about fatherhood now than ever did in the past, which is kind of thrilling. I think women's writing has really, at least in America, changed the course of the river.
Tell me some other ways, because I know you have some thoughts on how women's writing has really changed American writing.
That's one of them. I think men write with more openness about the body. I think more men, both poets and novelists and playwrights, write with a sense of women as people and not as objects. That's a pretty great piece of progress.
You know, when you were talking about men writing more openly about the body, I couldn't help think of one of the poems that I enjoyed so much. It's about men and their perception of their bodies and how they deal with it. But you know what I also loved about it is I think that one really shows your sense of humor, which comes out through your poetry, but Locker Room Conversation.
Right. Yes, I have to say, this is a true story, or at any rate, mostly true. Locker Room Conversation. There are some men my husband never sees with their pants on, though they work at the same university, guys from other departments. Men, it seems, don't bother wearing towels in the locker room. Though at his age, there's often plenty to hide. He and his buddies have eyed each other for so many years on and off the squash court. What would be the point? In the shower, they chat about their games, about the last op-ed, or they gossip and tell jokes and do business. He likes to describe this camaraderie, and I like to imagine the naked men in their various stages of beauty and decay, splashing, surrounded by brightly falling water, the muscular definition of smooth youth, the humorous pouchiness of the middle-aged, the crisp ligaments of the old, that squashy layer of boy fat under the skin at last consumed, their bodies like engravings you could title persistence or integrity, and sometimes even the very old, softened again like very old wool, all showering in a hum of conversation. He likes to mention some of the specimens I would enjoy. The big-necked boy athletes. The Indian MD in his 50s, graceful as Shiva. Today he tells me someone he's never seen walked into the shower. A kid, near 7 feet, black curly hair, bronze except for a bikini mark, blue eyes, face of an angel, body of a Greek hero, thighs the circumference of my husband's waist, dung of a god. And conversation stopped. Every man just soaped and rinsed himself. Afterward, as they dressed, my husband asked a couple of friends, "What did you think of that guy?" "What guy?" they said. They didn't really say that. And my husband got a certain amount of flack on that poem. But my favorite was a colleague of his who emailed him and said, "Tell Alicia that she got me just right, except that my eyes are green, not blue."
Locker room conversation from the 1996 book, The Crack in Everything. You're listening to Alicia Ostreicher here on New Letters on the Air. You know, you have a nice blend of humor, but with seriousness and facing the truth and sort of the grim realities that face us in life. You know, the aging of your parents, the fallouts that you have with people in the family, and then the remending of things and the difficulties that we have in life. You know, there's an interesting poem that you have. It's in one of your earlier books, and it deals with your father because it has to do with after death.
This one is called Meeting the Dead, and it's a poem I wrote 12 years after my father died. He died at the age of 53, fell over of a heart attack walking to work, and it was devastating for me because he was the one in my family who had given me unconditional love, just love with no strings attached. And I had loved him back, but he was shy and I was shy and we never had communicated to each other. It was just there. And I had always thought, well, one day we'll be old people together and we'll be able to talk. And then that was never going to be. And I mourned him very hard. So this is called Meeting the Dead. If we've loved them, it's what we want. And sometimes wanting works. With my father, it happened driving from Santa Monica to Pasadena. A night of a full moon, the freeway wide open, the palm trees black. I was recalling how for 2 years after that shy man's death, I thought only of death. How in April weather, I used to lock the Volkswagen window so nothing pleasant or fragrant would reach me. How one time I saw him staring in a ladies' room mirror and stood in my tracks, paralyzed. He looked so bitter, until his face dissolved back into my face. My radio was playing the usual late-night jazz. No other cars drove with me on the freeway. I hated it that we would never meet in mutual old age to drink a beer, it was all he ever drank, and declare our love the way I'd planned all through high school, picturing us in a sunny doorway facing a back garden. Something out of a book. I hated it that I was pushing 40 and could still curl like a snail, a fetus, weeping for him. While I was feeling that, the next things happened all at once, like iron slugs being pulled into a magnet. This has been mourning, I thought. Then a sound came, like a door clicking closed, and I understood right off that I was finished, that I would never feel any more misery for him. And at the same time, he was present. Had been, I now saw, all along, for these 12 years, waiting for me to finish my mourning. At that, I had to laugh, and he swiftly slipped from outside the Buick where he had been floating. I was still doing about 60. He was just in me. His round eye sockets were inside mine, his shoulder blades aligned with my own, his right foot and right palm lay with mine on the gas pedal and steering wheel. A treat for him, who'd never learned to drive. The San Gabriel foothills were approaching like parents, saying, "Here's a friend for life." And then they blocked the moon, and I was back on suburb streets. I was quietly passing the orderly gardens and homes of the living.
Meeting the Dead. That was originally included in the book The Imaginary Lover, which was published in 1986. And I think that won the William Carlos Williams Poetry Award.
It did.
And now it's included in The Little Space, Poems Selected and New 1968 to 1998. Alicia Ostreicher, talk a little bit about your connection to your faith and diving into that in your poetry.
Right.
Because a lot of times you'll have a quote from the scriptures and then you'll expand on it.
Right, and play with it and wrestle with it. I was raised Jewish but not religious, a secular Jew. My parents were left-wing. They were atheist socialist Jews was what they were, which is a special strand within Judaism. So my religious training consisted of being told that religion was the opiate of the people.
Oh, wow. That's so their generation, though,
that
isn't
was,
it?
That I mean, was that was
the whole
that
Marxist
generation. Exactly.
Yeah.
And what being a Jew meant was you studied, you worked hard, you were a good student, and you believed in social justice, and you were going to help bring about peace and brotherhood on earth. And I don't think that my parents were aware that their belief in social justice came to them from the biblical prophets, which it did. They didn't know that. They thought it came from Marx, but that's where Marx got it too. So I never had any religious training at all, and I read the Bible for the first time when I was in college, because my boyfriend, later my husband, said, "I think you should read this. I think you'll like it." And that was very fortunate, because I read it not because I had to, not as part of any kind of training, and not as part of a class, but as literature. And when I read it, it was instant bonding. I thought, this is my book. These men and women in these stories, they are my mothers and fathers. This God is my God, whether I like him or not. Sometimes I do. Sometimes I don't. But it was very much a feeling that this was my material, as if it were my dream. And I had always been drawn to religious poets, and especially to the heterodox religious poets. William Blake was my man. Walt Whitman. The poets with a spiritual dimension.
Gerard Manley Hopkins.
Yes.
I see the influence of his work in your poetry.
You see true. Yes. I memorized great hunks of Gerard Manley Hopkins. And the spiritual dimension in poetry had always been very important to me, but all of it was Christian. And I didn't recognize where all of that came from until I read the Bible and identified with it. I didn't do very much with it, although I used to take a lot of art courses. And if you walk into my home back in New Jersey, you'll see hanging on the wall as you come in an etching of Jacob wrestling the angel, which I did when I was 20, with the title, I Will Not Let Thee Go Except Thou Bless Me, which is, I think, one of the most beautiful lines in the Bible. And Jacob was the first biblical character I identified with, and my relation with the Bible and with Jewish tradition is a loving, wrestling relationship to wrestle a blessing out of this tradition, which in so many ways excludes women. But it's mine, and I'm not going to turn my back on it.
You're listening to a 2003 archive interview with now New York State poet Alicia Ostreicher, part of our State Poets Laureate series here on New Letters on the Air. Known for her Jewish feminist poetry, her 2017 collection, Waiting for the Light, won the National Jewish Award in Poetry that year. We'll finish out today's show with some selections from her 2002 collection, The Volcano Sequence, a psalm-like exploration of the spiritual and the personal. I asked Alicia Ostreicher to read the final poems that end four of the 9 sections of this very unusual collection, and for her to discuss the development of the volcano sequence.
That was a very different book for me. It's different from anything else I ever did. It had a different genesis. It had a different process. It began when I hadn't written any poetry for 3 years, and that was depressing, and I had other things I was depressed about. And I was looking at a tour guide to Santorini, which is the remnant of a volcanic island near Crete in Greece. And according to legend, that's the island which, when it blew, sank Atlantis. And as I was looking at the photographs of this beautiful but barren rocky crust, this poem came, which was in the voice of this extinct volcano, who was also myself. And it was telling me things about myself and anger and the damage that anger can do that I didn't really want to hear and that were very dark. But I realized I've been blocking something. That's why I'm not writing. I knew I was blocking. So I made a deal with the poems, different from anything I've ever done, which was, if you agree to keep on arriving, I agree not to tell you what to say. That was the bargain. And I did that for a year. So the book tracks that process of working through different kinds of pain, suffering, anger. I let the poems lie in the book where they fell as they came along during that year. And they are a meander. They don't have anything like a linear sequence. They turned out to be a voice or voices addressing a slippery you that is sometimes God and sometimes my mother, and I had problems with both. And I tried to keep out of the way of what the poems wanted to say and let them be as dark as they wanted to be. So the opening sequence is what first came to me and is called Volcano. Let me speak it to you in a whisper. I am like a volcano that has blown itself out of the water. My long stony curve, my melancholiac cliffs, a strip of old hard exoskeleton. The blue Aegean flows in and out of me. The tourists come, oh, they come, to stand where the lava flew. To imagine how the earth roared, showed teeth, bucked and heaved, to look for an hour at where the tidal wave began that destroyed Atlantis and created a myth, a green, good world. You remember. A woman looked at my poem. What is a volcano? She wanted to know. What makes you like a volcano? What would the world be like without the myth of Atlantis? The volcano is a crack in the earth. The volcano is a bulge over a crack. A fault line runs under it. Something terrible happens, and the magma coughs out hot beauty, thick and magnificent rage. So what if afterward everything is dead? The whole book meanders back and forth between poems addressing God and poems addressing the mother, and occasionally poems addressing the Shekhinah, who in Jewish mysticism, in Kabbalah, is the feminine aspect of God. And this is a mother section. Eyesight. Please, please, I can't see well. Reassure me with your touch. Or a tender word, the shade of a wing, just one jay feather or snail shell. Please visit me, listen to the story of my life. And the rhododendrons arrive, and so you've survived another winter, shaky through clotted retinas, cruelly reduced to one or two chopped letters at a time. Mother, you have spent a lifetime reading only to learn what words cannot accomplish. Though when I phone today, you say, there was so much sun. You sat outside. You could read again. The next day, bright sunshine, wind, life flaring up in the street. Dirt exhales grass. Treetops wave foliage ruffles like dancers, then shady lower boughs lift. The maples appear to be waltzing at the chlorophyll ball. Then, Mother, when I call, you say, you tried going out even with a coat. There was too much wind. Too much wind. The day after, you remind me you were a wild one. You used to beat up the boys on your block. You were teacher's pet. You won prizes for poetry. You had beautiful eyes. You tell your neighbor, I am your moon and stars. You are upset the plumber stole your purse. So I drive over and find it on the counter among the flies. The Shekhinah as mute. Our mothers tremble, vibrate, hesitate at the edge of speech, as at an unmade bed. Their mouths work confused. Our mothers helpless to tell us, she whom you seek sacrificed her place before the throne, dived into the atomic structure of matter and hides there, hair, wings streaming, womb compassionate, pitiless, eyes seeing to the ends of the universe in which life struggles and delights in life. They cannot take our hands, show us how to take comfort in raisins and apples, break apart laughing, spit seed. They cannot say, seek me. They teach us cooking, clothing, craftiness. They tell us their own stories of power and shame. And even if it is she who speaks through their mouths and has crawled through 10,000 wombs until this day, we cannot listen. Their words fall like spilled face powder. The very last section is about writing and the process of writing. And this is called Aperture. And it begins with three lines from three other poets, Auden, Adrienne Rich, and Shelley. To undo the folded lie, to change the laws of history, to be the trumpet of a prophecy? Who planted this seed in our muddy minds? Who put pencil and tablet in our hands? Who turned on the microphone? Started running the tape that repeats, write it, write it, make a fool of yourself. I see myself as an aperture. Words pass through, addressing, imagining, inventing. One, of whom nothing is known that is not words. I am pressing hard. I am pressing down. It hurts so much. It does not hurt at all. It simply flies. It is the effort to imagine what needs to be imagined. It is the desperation to imagine what needs to be imagined by us in order to exist. And it wants to come into existence. It cannot exist yet. Something else exists that is not adequate, not at all adequate, and so it needs to burst forth from that place. But it hurts. What reaches? What answers? From time to time, something does answer, like the surface tension in a cup of silence, trembling. What do I imagine is happening? It calls me. What I enjoy is when it blows through me, music I cannot name, summoned by the strong force of the computer, sounding like a wild virtual horn in another room. I run upstairs, happy now that I am its attachment or appendage. You got me under the skin of my chest, not that I can locate, really, where the waves sway. Because the truth is, the perishing world exists. But then, you see, there is the eternal, center everywhere, circumference nowhere, inside, outside. And means to align the two are available, dearly beloved friends. Trees, animals, kisses, cars, computers, drugs, music, meditation, or the spite of war, open windows, and the divinity pours through like hot sunlight. Oh God, the relief. The open secret drives through, crashes, the barriers splinter, a ball of light waves. Coda, I want everyone to understand these lines. Say nothing. Sometimes the stories take you and fling you against a wall. Sometimes you go right through the wall.
Alicia Ostriker, reading from her book, The Volcano Sequence, published in 2002 by the University of Pittsburgh Press, which has published 9 of her 15 poetry books, including her 2017, Waiting for the Light. Alicia Ostriker was appointed State Poet of New York in 2018, alongside Colson Whitehead as the New York State author, both serving until 2020. Interesting note, as we were putting together the State Poets Laureate season, we discovered we have archive interviews with almost all of the 11 New York State poets, past and present. Feel free to check out our archives on our website, newletters.org, where you can subscribe to our free weekly podcast under Ways to Listen, or wherever you find your podcast. If you appreciate what we do, please consider donating to our literary operation by clicking on the Support New Letters button in the top right corner of newletters.org. For updates, you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters Magazine, published by the University of Missouri, Kansas City, with partial financial support from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Today's show was originally produced with Leslie Koffler, Tina Meggs, Alex Smith, and Shuping Singh. Also thanks to Anna Stokes and Jamie Walsh, and to you for listening. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.